Welcome to Sunday Assembly Madison. For those of us, or for those of you who have not been here before, Sunday Assembly is a godless congregation. We celebrate life and all of the fun stuff that happens while we live, because we only get one life, so let's celebrate it, right? We generally do some singing and some dancing and a nice presentation. We do this once a month.
When did the dancing start?
Done. See, I'm expecting you to dance. Oh, no? Oh, okay.
You're confused.
I'm confused. All right, then. Wrong place, wrong time? Okay. So, anyway, welcome. That's who we are. So, next we're going to do a reading, which we're going to do a reading a little bit different this time. I'm going to read this one because I thought this was my favorite Carl Sagan quote. The cosmos is within us. We're made of star stuff. Sorry, I need to do Carl Sagan. The cosmos is within us. We're made of star stuff. We are a way for the cosmos to know itself, along with its billions and billions of stars. Thank you. I'll be here all week. Now, we're going to have John come up and give his piece on our place in the cosmos. And I forgot to print out John's introduction, which he said that's okay. He's got his own. So a man who brings his own introduction, John.
All right, so this is a repeat of a presentation I gave to Prairie Unitarian Society last fall. I don't even remember when I gave it, but I've given this presentation several times to schools and at the Wyalusing Observatory. So, as you can see, I didn't change all the slides, but I thought I might also put in a little plug for Unitarian Universalism. I don't really see a whole lot of separation between Sunday Assembly and Unitarian Church. For those of you who haven't been to the Unitarian Church, it might be something to consider. I would say maybe Unitarians have 0.2% Christians or religious people, whereas you guys probably have 0.1. So, my background a little bit here. I really strongly believe in the scientific method. And when I was creating this for our church, I was trying to come up with how to describe my belief in the scientific method. Is it a belief? Is it faith? Didn't really work, but when you consider that the universe is made up of 99.99 with probably about 1,000 nines after it, percent of the universe is not hospitable to human life. Do you really think some creator made this for humans? I kind of doubt it. Was it a lucky accident? Probably. And do we really need supernatural explanations for the universe when the reality is so amazing?
Damn it. There you go.
So my background. My very first experience that I can remember in my life was playing in our neighbor's playground in a sandbox, and the mother coming out, I don't remember her name, she came out and said, John, you gotta run home, you gotta go now and see the TV. And I did, I ran home, got into our living room, and my family was all huddled around our little black and white TV, and I got there right as Neil Armstrong was stepping down the ladder. So that's my first ever memory. I've always been interested in astronomy. But when on my 40th birthday, my mother sent me a nice fat check, and I said, telescope. So it was my first real telescope, and that was a few years ago. And as I was exploring the telescope and learning about it, I Googled the astronomy clubs in the area, and there weren't any. But I found a guy in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, who was also very into astronomy, and we hooked up, and he actually started an astronomy class, and we got together, and we formed the Iowa County Astronomers, and this will be our 10th year this year. I also help out with Universe in the Park. I haven't done that in a while, but if you haven't been to any state parks where they have Universe in the Park, it's a great program. They do something similar to what I'm doing. They'll give like a 20-minute lecture, and then they'll go out to the parking lot, and they have telescope setups where you can look at different objects in the sky. And then if you get serious about astronomy and buy a telescope, there's no end in how much money you can spend. It's a true black hole.
And that's not even the camera yet.
Right. Okay. There. So my presentation today consists of three parts. The first part is humanizing space and distance concepts. And then I'll talk a little bit about my experience with astrophotography. And then finally, I'm going to talk about recent space mission results from NASA. So, distance.
Pointing.
So, how far away is the moon? Now, also interesting, I heard some people talking earlier, and this may be the highest level IQ of any group I've ever presented before, so I suspect some of you will know some of these questions already. So, how far away is the moon? Not in miles per hour, but imagine if we could create a highway, a superhighway, from the Earth to the moon, and they set the speed limit at 65 miles an hour. How long do you think it'll take you in your little Toyota RAV4 to get there?
Oh, gosh.
I know that it's 36 and a half Earth diameters to the moon.
Okay. You can extrapolate that. Any thoughts?
8,000 times 36 and a half, something you do in your head.
All right, I'll just tell you.
3 days?
2 days.
153 days.
That's driving 24 hours a day.
Yes, it is.
Yes, no body
breaks. No body breaks. 24 hours.
Where are you going to stop?
So 238,000 miles. Now, how far away is the sun? Same deal. We're going to set a highway from the
sun. I know, it's 1 AU.
What's that?
It's 1 AU.
1 AU, yeah. No. But 65 miles an hour to the sun. Any ideas, guesses?
322 times further away than the moon.
That's probably correct. 163 years. Again, no potty breaks. 93 million miles. So given that information and a lot of digits, miles are not a practical way to measure distance, astronomical distances. Since light is the fastest thing in the universe, it travels at 186,000 miles per second. It can circle the Earth 7 times in 1 second. Now, with our green laser pointer, at the speed of light, how long does it take to get to the moon?
One and a third second.
You got it perfectly. 1.3 seconds. And this little picture here is when Einstein developed his theory of relativity, his thought experiment was, could you ride a beam of light? And what would happen if you're riding a beam of light? So I stuck a jockey on the laser beam. In the sun, oops, I must have missed a slide. I didn't stick it in there. All right. How far away is the sun? 8 minutes. So if the sun blew up right now, we wouldn't know about it for 8 minutes.
And then it'd be a big surprise.
So some solar system distances in light speed. The moon, like we said, 1.3 seconds. Oh, one interesting thing about the moon. So for those of you who were able to see the moon landings, if you noticed, and this was in the age before cell phones with the delay, there was a delay with the astronauts talking to mission control of about 3 seconds because the light had to go up there and come all the way back down, the radio transmissions. Sun is 8 minutes out, Mars 12 minutes, Jupiter 43, Saturn 1.3 hours, and Pluto 5.5 hours.
Where's Uranus?
Say Uranus.
Was that another question over here?
Yeah. When you say 12 minutes to Mars from...
That's the average distance from Earth to Mars in light speed.
Okay, I gotcha.
That's right. It depends on which side of the Earth, but it's the average.
So 12 minutes.
Wait, is Pluto a planet again?
No.
It's a dwarf planet.
Didn't they?
It's a planet.
So the nearest star system to us is 4.4 years, again at the speed of light, and it's Alpha Centauri system. And the interesting thing about Alpha Centauri is it's not a single star, it's actually a trinary star system, three stars that are all orbiting each other. And another interesting fact is that most stars in the Milky Way are actually multiple star systems. So, you know, when you saw Star Wars and the two stars that Luke at sunset, that was probably reality, you know. I'm sorry, I missed that. And then the Milky Way galaxy, it's about 100,000 light years in diameter. And this picture is actually NASA's latest a simulation of what the Milky Way galaxy looks like. And that's our place in the galaxy. Now we're going out past our galaxy. Now we're up to the nearest other galaxy to the Milky Way, not including the dwarf galaxies, is 2.5 million years. That beam of light.
Light years?
Light years.
Oh, shoot.
Oops. Ah, and now I've gone out to, is this the next one?
What are the Magellanic Clouds galaxies?
Yeah, they're I think they're called dwarf galaxies.
Okay, are they closer or further?
They're a lot closer. They're basically in orbit around the Milky Way. But I think they're something on 100,000 light years distance, so they're quite close, relatively close. So the most distant object known, and actually I have to update the slide, they found another gamma ray burst even farther than this one. And this is, again, this is rounding, 13 billion years. It's actually, I don't know what the exact number is, but that's close enough for jazz. So, in summary for distances, light speed is how astronomers measure distance, a measurement of how far light travels over time. The moon distance of 1.3 seconds is at the same scale of the edge of the universe at 13 billion years. That's kind of a hard to wrap your head around.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure.
Please.
So it's the same scale. So shooting that beam of light to the moon will take 1 second to reach the moon with that beam of light. That same beam of light reaching that gamma ray burst at the edge of the universe will take 13 billion years. That's how far away the edge of the universe is. It's hard to wrap it around. Hopefully that helped. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering what they mean by the edge.
That's a good question. So we don't really know if there's something beyond the outermost part of the galaxy because we can't see it. And the reason is that the farther away objects are in space, the faster they're moving away from us. And that causes something called a redshift effect. So light gets stretched. And light is stretched so far that it's like not even visible at 13 billion years out.
Oh, so that's what they call the edge.
That's what they call
it.
It's not like Star Trek where there's this big barrier.
Or city where you look around the billboard.
Right, yeah. It's just the outermost part, yeah.
So this is a brief article I read not too long ago that said, so all of the numbers you're quoting here are light, speed of light in a vacuum. There was an experiment done where the speed of light, so usually once it goes through some other sort of medium, it slows down and then kicks right back up.
Right.
There were certain cases where they were able to keep it slow.
Yeah. Very
slow. Call into question any
very
of these?
Slow. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Because the amount of material in interstellar space is so, even though there's a lot of space between us, it's mostly vacuum, or, you know, even vacuum is not really vacuum, but I don't think it significantly affects
okay.
this.
But even given the amount of space and the potentially slightly increased probability,
I've thought that same thing. I don't know. I got to believe that people took that into account. The scientists, they're pretty smart with this, the way the universe is expanding. That's something else I wasn't going to go into. But you know, the Big Bang Theory came about when scientists noticed that the farther away objects were from us, the faster they were moving away from us. And they did an experiment to see, is there going to be a big, is the universe going to expand forever and then just get dark? Or is it going to stop and then start moving backwards? So they were measuring to see how much the universe expansion was slowing as it's going out. Turns out it's not slowing at all, it's actually accelerating. So the farther things are out away from us, the faster they're accelerating away from us. That's kind of another crazy thing. That's one of the most interesting discoveries in the last few years, and they call that dark energy. They don't know what is causing that. No more questions, we'll move on. So for size, this is another NASA chart that shows the relative sizes of the planets. And as of last week, they think there may be a real ninth planet. Some of you might have heard that news article. We can maybe talk about that later.
What did you call it? I'm sorry, or what?
What's that?
You said they think there's a
ninth planet.
Oh, ninth planet.
Not Pluto.
Very tilted with respect to the ecliptic.
Right, it's got a very
mostly detected mathematically.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't have firm data on it, but from everything I've been reading, the science is looking pretty good on this.
There's some very positive indications because the predictions of the model find things that make the predictions of the model.
Right.
Which is unusual for these things.
Yeah. So this is a little journey outward from the Earth. Here are the Earth and three other planets and one dwarf. This chart was made when Pluto was still a planet. And now you're going outward. So you can see here's the Earth here in relation to the gas giants. And there's the Earth compared to the Sun, just a smudge. And Earth is invisible at this scale. And Jupiter is one pixel. So we've got the Sun, and then these are larger stars than our Sun. Sirius, Pollux, Arcturus. Going out further, our Sun is now at one pixel in the scale to these objects. Sirius, Pollux from the last slide, Arcturus, Rigel, Aldebaran, Betelgeuse, and Antares.
Are there a lot of suns smaller than us, or we're so tiny.
At this scale, our Sun is one pixel.
But like, are we like the smallest star?
Oh no, ours is very average. Smaller stars. Yeah. There are smaller stars than ours, and there's also things called brown dwarfs, which are basically like almost stars. They're basically everything in the scale in between. Yeah.
I think 70% of all stars are red dwarfs. How would they figure in terms of size compared to, say, Earth or Antarctica?
Yeah, they're quite a bit smaller than our Sun. Yeah. It's just the bigger ones are more interesting. That's why I got them on the slide.
Yeah.
Oh, and the interesting fun fact about Antares: if Antares was our Sun, we would be orbiting inside it.
Yeah.
Sure. Where do these tend to appear? What's like the density function for where the large stars appear? Is it closer to the galactic center, or?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know the answer to that.
I recently just looked up, I was talking to some school children about how many Earths could fit inside our Sun. And when you look how small the Sun is compared to these other stars, but 1 million, I think they said it was between 1,200,000 and 1,300,000 Earths
million
can fit inside our Sun, which means, God, I can imagine.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to even wrap your brain. A lot of this is hard to wrap. Come on. Yeah.
So our Sun is measured with a good span.
Yeah.
Can we put the projected maximum size of that versus some of the other stars?
It'll become a red giant, similar to some of the largest ones there.
Oh, wow.
That's what one of the projections is, that the surface will eventually get out to the orbit of Earth.
Yeah, I heard right now our Sun is considered a yellow dwarf. Is that correct?
I haven't heard dwarf. Yellow dwarf, just a yellow star.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't.
Did you say the edge of the Sun would expand to the point that it would contact the Earth?
Yeah.
Holy wow, that's a huge expansion.
It's a long time.
I'm worried.
Long dust.
I think there is such a thing as yellow dwarfs, but it's like Van Manen's star.
Yeah, I don't. I haven't heard of it.
Okay.
Which is smaller than our Sun.
Yeah. All right. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the astrophotography that I've done. This is a picture of my yard in Mineral Point, where I lived for 20 years before the observatory was built. There used to be a really beautiful maple tree here, but it split right down the middle, and I had to get rid of it, so I decided to put it in an observatory. It's a concrete P pure being poured, and to this day, this was almost 20 years ago, it was about 10 years ago. If you drive out to this house still, you'll see the ruts from this truck. The deck, and there's the completed building.
Wow.
And you already showed that slide. That's what the equipment I use for all of the images coming up here.
Wow.
It's a 10-inch Schmidt Cassegrain telescope with a piggybacked apochromatic refractor on top. So the moon, this one didn't work either. It's supposed to say 1.3 seconds. All of these pictures, I put the distance to them from my previous presentation here. This is the Hercules star cluster at 25,000 light years across. This is an interesting object because it's basically a ball. If you could fly around it, it's like a basketball in space of stars. And kind of an interesting thought experiment would be what would it be like to be on a planet inside of this thing? If you look up at night, it would just be diamonds everywhere. This is Galaxy M33, and this is outside of the Milky Way galaxy. This is 2.6 million light years away. The Pleiades, this is fairly close at 440 light years. The Cave Nebula, 2400 light years. The Galaxy M51 at 25 million light years. And this was fun. We had in our astronomy club, one of our members donated a 17-inch Dobsonian telescope, which is it's about 7 feet tall, and it's the primary mirror is like this. There was a supernova right about here in M51 a couple of years ago, or it was about 4 years ago, and we were able to see it easily with that big telescope. It just looked like a kind of a bright star. But you know, think about that. We were seeing a star in another galaxy, or a supernova in another galaxy, with our eyes. This is one of my favorite shots. This is the Bubble Nebula, inside this nebula is a very energetic star that's throwing off its outer layers and interacting with the dust around the star. This is Galaxy NGC 891, 28 million light years. This is a Crab Nebula. This is one of my favorite objects, not visually, but this object, it's a supernova. And it went supernova, blanking when it was. I think it was like 2000 BC. But China's astronomers actually recorded the event. Because it was very memorable because it basically was a new star visible in the sky. But more than that, this star was visible all day long during the day, is how bright it was. For about a month, it was visible in the day. And then over time, it faded and wasn't rediscovered until the 1700s. And it's also interesting, there are some pictures on the internet of this. We've been photographing this long enough that they've made animations of it. It's expanding. You can, from the images that were taken like 30 years ago to today, you can see the explosion continuing to move. The Cocoon Nebula. And several of these pictures I took using something called narrowband imaging. It uses a certain spectrum of light that brings out more of the dust. And astrophotographers color that it wouldn't be visible to the human eye, but it's on the red end of the spectrum. So we just color, put that into the red channel. Galaxy M81, 12 billion light years away. Crescent Nebula, this is an interesting object. This is in the center of this nebula is something called the Wolf-Rayet star, which is, it's kind of like a planetary nebula, but it's basically unstable and it's throwing out its atmosphere. That's what makes up all of the all of the material is blown off the star. And this is called the Ghost Nebula. It's a good one for Halloween. If you look, looks like somebody here is like screaming and running away, these guys from the big ghost here. Horsehead Nebula. Probably all seen that before. In the Orion Nebula, this is a fun one because I my daughter actually did the color data for this for a project for her high school science class. Sunflower Galaxy, Black Eye Galaxy, you can see the it got punched. And last one is the Whale Galaxy. Questions on astrophotography? Yeah.
Actually, I just wanted to ask, what, again, pardon my ignorance, difference between nebula and a galaxy?
Yeah, so there are several different types of nebulas. Basically, nebulas are gas or material in space. And they're a lot, you know, a galaxy is 100,000 light years typically across. That's how big our galaxy is. A nebula will be like 1 light year across. They're just balls of dust. Or planetary nebulas are stars at the end of their lives that are throwing out their atmosphere. So they're small, whereas a galaxy contains billions of stars. Billions and billions. Yeah.
I assume this requires a tracking telescope.
Yeah.
I wondered how long the exposures would be.
Oh yeah, good question. Most of the narrowband images I take, it's kind of complicated. For narrowband, I do about 30-minute what's called sub-exposures. So you take individual images and then you digitally stack them to increase the signal-to-noise ratio so that you can make them look clean. Cleans up the data, basically. Most of the color data is I do 5-minute sub-exposures. But in general, the total exposure time for these pictures would be anywhere from 4 to 15 hours on a single object.
Who like hires astrophotographers?
Hires them?
Like who?
I would love to know.
Be doing work for?
What's
that? What I'm saying? Who would an astrophotographer be doing their work for?
Yeah,
like, well, government or for? Like,
yeah, I'm kind of at the level where I'm almost good enough to get published, but there are a lot of science magazines and like there are 2 or 3 astronomy magazines that buy astrophotography, but the people that do that are like have crazy equipment.
And I have another quick question. It seems to me years ago, several years ago, I read something about that there had been a decision made because of funding that they were just going to basically let the Hubble telescope go and not maintain it and just sort of let it, you know, fall apart. Is that still happening? Or
yeah, it's still happening, but I think that they've re-upped its mission several times, but there's a new.
So it's still in operation.
It's still in operation right now, yeah. But I think it's going to be just a few more years. And the James, I think it's called James Webb Telescope is coming.
James Webb.
But that's going to be primarily an infrared scope, I think, right?
It should come online. I think they're on 2018.
Yeah, I think that's going to be up before Hubble comes down. So that'll be. Hopefully, we won't lose any of our pretty pictures.
I was pleasantly surprised by the public outcry and it kept Hubble alive.
Yeah. Pretty amazing, really. And it's even more amazing when the thing went up, it had, you know, I don't know if some of you might not even like it. When it first went up, the mirror was not formed properly, and it was blurry.
Yeah.
And then they had to go up and send up a few heroes to rescue it, and that's quite a story. There's a IMAX movie about the repair of Hubble. I think it's on Netflix streaming now, too, if you want. So, any other questions before we go on? Okay. Oh, a couple of telescope tips if you get the opportunity to do viewing through a telescope. When you're viewing objects at night, it takes 30 minutes for your eyes to get completely dark adapted so that you can have the best experience at a telescope. And if you have any type of white light source at all, your clock resets and you've got to start over. So if you're out in the country doing using telescopes, make sure to keep white lights off. When looking through a telescope, you're not going to see the pretty pictures that I'm showing you here. The objects that you're looking at are so dim that only the, I think it's the rods, whatever the black and white bit of our eyeballs are activated. So you can't see any color in general, unless you have a big enough telescope, which you got to have a huge telescope. And even then, you can only see color in a couple of objects, like the Orion Nebula, if you're lucky. But mostly it's a black and white hobby. And then never look through the sun or view the sun through a telescope unless you have the right filter, because I'm sure some of you like zapped ants with magnifying glasses. Imagine holding up a 10-inch magnifying glass and focusing it on your eyeball. That's what it would be doing. Bad.
But don't make like Galileo.
What's that?
Don't do like Galileo. I mean, he found the sunspot, so he had to be looking.
I think he projected. I think he projected it on the surface.
Oh, he knew to do that.
What's that? Yeah, he could do that. And again,
he knew that he had to do that.
I
understood that.
Yeah, I didn't hear that. I think he was blinded, so he must have figured it out. But, and he, also, his telescopes were terrible. By today's standards, they were really rotten. So current space missions in the last, these are basically the big hitters from the last year, other than the Martian explorers are still up there. But so Dawn was launched September 27th, 2007. It's the only spacecraft to have visited two different bodies, although Pluto's going to be kind of doing it. But this is the only spacecraft that's ever orbited two different bodies. Very exciting. It uses something called ion drive, which is a super efficient but super slow propulsion technology. So this is a video of Vesta, the first body that it visited. It's 326 miles in diameter. It rotates every 5 hours. And if I was standing on Vesta, I'd weigh 3 pounds. Dawn approaching Ceres, actually it's arrived now. It's 590 miles in diameter, rotational period 9 hours. I weigh a full 4 pounds on there. Unknown white spots, they're actually pretty well known now. And I'll talk about that here in a minute. But you can see on this picture that looks like a spotlight. Here's what those spotlights look like. This is a special picture that NASA did using multiple exposures. Because the difference between the light and the dark are just so extreme that they had to take short exposures to get the light material and longer exposures to get the dark. The surface of Ceres is roughly the color of freshly poured asphalt. And the white material is the color of snow, so it's very distinctively different. Oh yeah, this is what the white spots are made out of. Epsom salt. If you have constipation, it'd be a good place to go. Rosetta is a comet spacecraft launched in 2004. It had a lander that went down to the surface of the comet. Unfortunately, the mechanism they had to have it land didn't work, and it bounced. And it bounced several miles in the air, and then came down and bounced like 8 times before it came to a rest. And after all of that, it still functioned for a few hours. it's very low surface gravity. A human could probably jump and reach escape velocity from the surface. It's only 2 miles in diameter. And the spacecraft, after providing the initial data, actually this last year, it woke up and transmitted when the comet, so this is a comet that's coming into the sun. And when it got closer to the sun, the lander spacecraft had enough electricity to phone home, but it didn't provide any more data. It was real intermittent. And the mothership, there's an orbiter. They're going to try to soft land that orbiter later this year. Yeah?
Who launched Dawn? Was that us?
Yeah, us. Yes, I'm pretty sure that was NASA. Actually, I'm not sure. Did I talk about that?
Yes.
Oh, no, it's not us. European Space Agency, ESA. So I'm sure we were part of it, but it was headed by the European Space Agency.
They're talking about Rosetta.
What's that? Rosetta. Oh, Dawn, sorry, Dawn. Dawn was us, yes. So this is some pictures of Rosetta. This is kind of a good one. There's tons of these on NASA's website if you
what
want to look around.
What's 67P mean in this context?
What's that?
What's the 67P mean?
That, I'm sorry, that's the name of the comet.
Oh, okay.
And this is a picture of when it just started. It was getting close enough to the sun, it started ejecting material. And the spacecraft continued, the one that's in orbit continues to work even with all this material flying off of it. And then the last spacecraft I'm talking about is New Horizons, launched January 2006. Fastest spacecraft ever, 36,000 miles per hour, 100 times faster than a jetliner. It will travel 32 times the Earth-Sun distance, or did. Arrived at Pluto July 14th last year, and it just zoomed by and kept going. They've chosen another body. I don't know how large this is, but it's a like an asteroid, basically, that it's going to fly by in January of 2019. And this is this is actually, last time I gave the presentation, this was the best pictures we had ever had of Pluto and Charon, or Charon, I think it's Charon. But now we got much better pictures. Anybody know what's wrong with this picture of Pluto? That's not Pluto, that's Charon. That's the moon of Pluto.
Yeah, because Pluto's got the heart-shaped discoloration.
Right, this is Pluto. But it's pretty awesome that the moon of Pluto is almost as big as Pluto itself. Or it's like a half the size.
Yeah, a lot of people seem bummed about the whole demotion thing, but I think Clyde Comet should get credit for finding the first of a new class of objects.
Yeah, right.
Which is pretty amazing.
And it's still a planet. We can talk about that later.
I didn't know why. I was like, oh, I was like, oh.
More pictures. This is a good one. It looks like you can see a little bit of atmosphere possibly there. And it's continuing. So when this spacecraft went by Pluto, it took just tons of data. But the transmission rate, because this thing is so far away, the transmission rate is something like 2K, 2 kilobits of data per second. So it's taking a long time for all of this information to reach us. This is a really interesting shot that there's like some sort of plane. They think these mountains are made out of ice and the plane is made out of frozen nitrogen. Mm. And that's all I got for you.
Can I just ask a moment?
Absolutely.
Are we ever going to have like people going out to see an object up close again, or are the days of doing it on? Like, we did this experiment.
This year, NASA's funding for the first time in a long time got bumped up by over $1 billion. So
it hasn't been approved yet, has it?
I think so.
Yeah.
Really?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the budget that Paul Ryan sent through that everybody free, all the Republicans free.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I was probably shocked by that. I just didn't believe it until the.
Yeah.
So there's going to be people.
What's that?
There's going to be people on it.
Well, it's going to cost a lot more than $1 billion to get humans there. But it's a good start.
Where?
To Mars.
To Mars.
Yeah,
Mars.
That's what NASA's main planetary, human planetary exploration is targeted at Mars. Unfortunately, I think it should be the moon. But
I'm pretty excited with Elon Musk and his efforts. He has a fairly large vision and is putting a lot of his own personal wealth behind it.
Yeah, is he?
SpaceX.
Is he specifically looking at Mars? Or?
He's looking at Mars, but with Elon, you never know what he's going to be doing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was talking about nuking Mars. Did you hear that one?
Yeah, yeah. Nuking the poles.
Yeah, nuking the poles.
So
that
he evaporates the water in the poles and creates an atmosphere.
Yeah, there's so many things wrong with that.
Speed
terraforming. There's not that much water up there.
There's a lot more water than we thought before.
Yeah,
there's not only the water at the poles, but it still leaches off into space.
The
numbers that were done in the model said that even if you were to have all that water evaporate, it would not be enough to create a sustainable atmosphere on the surface of Mars.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my opinion, is if there was enough to have a sustainable atmosphere,
Mars already has an atmosphere.
Right.
Well, there's that, yes.
So I'm curious, you just sort of had a side comment where you said you think we should be headed for the moon again instead of Mars.
I don't
want to elaborate on that.
I think it would be better or more practical to get an established base as a launching point
I'd rather be a belter. Yeah. I mean, I just, why re-enter a gravity well if you don't have to? You could make the case for...
If something, the problem is, from my standpoint, if something goes wrong on the moon, it's only a couple of days to get there. If something goes wrong on Mars...
If something goes wrong anywhere other than low Earth orbit, you're kind of horrible.
Yeah, even low Earth orbit, you're kind of in trouble.
Talking about lower orbit, are there any plans to replace a space shuttle with anything so that we can send somebody, for instance, out to the International Space Station?
For the United States? Yeah, no, they are. Yep. Well, even SpaceX is—they're getting real close to being
able to launch into space. I think we're getting to the point where NASA wants to commercialize that aspect of it. So the U.S. basically screwed up badly when we got rid of the Saturn V's. We lost our heavy launch capability, and they're trying. They've had some plans to get it back, as well as I want to call it the Constellation program.
I think that's right.
And basically, they're like, look, why are we doing this? One, we can get rides with the Russians. And two, SpaceX is going to be what, their Dragon? I'm trying to remember the name of their capsule program. But
yeah,
basically, it's like, this is, you know, NASA should be out of the forefront doing the wild and crazy.
Right.
And leave, the crew modules are well understood problems.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's still rocket science, but.
All right, thanks a lot.